Welcome to the Friday Workplace Briefing. Workplace law changes so quickly. Tune in weekly to find out how the law is changing and what you need to do.
G'day, Matt. How are you?
Good morning, Andrew. I'm doing very well. Thank you.
Yeah, look at me, straight from the plane.
I know. I made sure to shave up today.
I know, a little bit. Yes, thanks for that, Matt.
Yeah.
We're actually live today.
Yes, I mean, we're always live. Well, that's true.
I'm barely alive.
I was going to say, we're living in different ways.
But we've had a bit of a technology hitch for our usual recording. Mm. As a result of that, when we finish this, it goes out like that. Mm. So if I swear during the middle of it, you're going to hear it.
That's right. That's true.
We haven't got Zoom here, so there's nothing.
The likelihood of swearing is diminished. No, that's true. So yeah, that's 75% decrease immediately, Andrew.
So we've had a bit of a quiet week, but next week is going to be really exciting. I just saw the Mango case come through.
For the zombie deals.
We're going to talk about zombie deals later on. Chevron. And interest-based bargaining.
Yeah,
I don't know if everyone understands interest-based bargaining. With large unions, it's nonsense. I just want to put that out there very quickly. But it's where Matt, as a unionist, me as an employer, get together, and we share the underlying interests of each other in a way which is candid. We expose the nature of the business case. We expose the nature of what's important to employees, and the collaborative and generous process you come forward to create an enterprise agreement. Mm. And there are some two or three commissioners, ex-commissioners, who are out there doing this, who are doing an amazing job.
Creating.
Can I just say that doesn't work with hard-skin unions?
No, that's fair.
Who take advantage of it, like the CFMEU, the AWU. Mm. There's a number of those unions who actually leverage off it. And we see Chevron this week, after months of very careful and generous negotiation, just went and put the management deal to the workers.
Yeah.
So,
which is the last stop sort of outcome.
I want to say this, Matt, and I know this is bordering on politics, so I'm being careful, as I say. We've now got Labor governments in every state. We've got a Labor federal government, a reformist federal Labor government. Mm. We're not seeing any greater union membership, but we are seeing unions being given the leash, being allowed to run, and we're starting to see the types of disputes which are really unhelpful, and the unions feel emboldened in this process as they're coming through.
Fair.
So
as we talk
to you over the next 6 weeks, we're going to be telling you about disputes that didn't need to happen.
Mm.
The other part is the DNA of unions is deteriorating, so the quality of the people that you're dealing with in unions is not what it once was.
It's like the pool is smaller.
The fish are starting to get 8 fins rather than 2. So the types of disputes that once could have been dealt with through a conversation over a coffee with a union organiser, if it's important for them to have a fight, they're having a fight.
Yeah, that's a bit.
I'm going to deal with the virgin fight a little bit later.
Yeah, true.
But I want you to understand there is a move in the landscape. Any opportunity is a fight. If you're a large employer, we're starting to see it with the CPSU and FSU around flexible working, where they're hailing tearing organisations apart.
They filed an application against Commonwealth Bank.
We're seeing unions in an opportunistic way shredding workforce capability as a way of finding relevance, because the truth is all great industrial change had happened by the year 2000.
That's interesting.
You know, when you look at all the major things about the protections, the leaves, all those things, that agenda had been delivered. And since that time, union membership has plummeted.
Yes. Yeah.
Most of them are living off their capital and unable to sustain themselves from their own fees. Mm-hmm. And we're getting now returned to a belligerence, which I think is really unhelpful.
Yeah, it's a bit unclear what the strategy is in that respect. It seems to be trying old tricks to see if they'll have benefit again. I don't think the appetite for the community at large is for that disputation. When one looks at sort of what happened at the federal political level, it was a push away from that traditional sort of oppositional sort of tactics of politics. Same sort of concept here. It's that oppositional approach to bargaining.
Yeah, and if you look at where union membership is thick, it's in the over 45.
That's right. It's a particular demographic. It's fair. I think that they did, because of the large proportion of women in midwives and nurses and so on, it's actually a bit of an unusually skewed demographic.
It is, absolutely.
Unions. But you're right, like when we think of sort of who is the traditional out there, sort of rah-rah style union membership, I agree.
That is true. The ANMF have taken over as the major unions.
That's right.
Interesting times. Let's get into it anyway. I thought I'd just
contextualise
a little bit where we're going to talk about.
Absolutely.
Matt, BHP.
Yeah, so, yeah.
And the sneaky tactics, which have come unrolled very quickly.
Yeah. So they've already copped a whack twice now, the first instance at the full federal court about this meaning of requesting an employee to work on a public holiday. They had the contractual arrangements in place that effectively said you're agreeing to work the public holidays, and if you don't want to, you'll have to take annual leave. Now, the full federal court said that was not a proper exercise of a request. That's a requirement, and accordingly, that was unlawful.
Can I just say at this stage, isn't it funny to when a word request comes through, which is unquestionably one for which you're allowed to refuse?
Yes, yeah.
To elevate that to requirement and then characterise it as a request. I mean, you've got to have a good sense of humour to do that.
That's very true. It's a bold approach, I would say. So, yes, look, effectively, they've just indicated that they're going to make the lodge the appeal with the High Court to ask them to consider. Really interestingly, this sort of meaning of this language, can we stretch it and stress it so it doesn't have what is very clear the plain English meaning of it? It's not impossible, but it'll be very interesting to see what the court
interesting to say. Hard to see the High Court getting that interested because the plain meaning's so clear.
Yeah.
But we'll wait and see. And as Matt said to me the other day, it is a really big issue because people being forced to work on holidays is an issue which will agitate the High Court.
Absolutely. Well, I think it's NES. If you get an NES entitlement, but this is why everyone wanted the reasonable overtime one for the Monique Ryan dispute to go through, because it was a hope that there would be some jurisprudence created around this. And at the moment, it's again one of those areas where there's not a lot. High Court might like to make its mark on
big mistake, country. Though, for BHP. We've got a black letter High Court. They're just going to go to the ordinary meaning.
That's right.
There's going to be no nuance from them.
It's not the bench you want to bring this one in front of.
Yeah. Okay. The expiry of the COVID vaccination information regs is really quite a narrow topic. Victoria specific. It's where the government has removed compulsory vaccination, any medical evidence around compulsory vaccination.
Yes.
You've got to get rid of.
That's right, yeah. So the regulation just provided a lawful method to collect, record and retain.
This is under the Health Records Act, I should say, which is a privacy legislation in Victoria.
Yeah, well, it was a regulation under the OH&S Act. So
I understand that, but it was under the Health Records Act, which allowed you to capture it.
Oh, correct. Sorry, yes, absolutely. Yes. So really this is just removing that lawful power.
Yep.
Really means that you've now got to have that other source. So do you have that properly backed up vaccination policy that's in place that you've gone through consultation as required under OH&S that you've implemented properly.
Yeah, and then you're allowed to collect those things
exactly.
To the degree that it remains relevant.
I mean, I think to the extent that anyone's doing it, and we're seeing fewer and fewer employers are citing the records is probably the better way to do it, just so you don't have to delve into this issue of collecting and recording and retaining those privacy records.
Okay, zombie deals.
Yeah, so obviously we spoke last week about the first sort of rejection of an attempted extension of a zombie deal, but here we've got our first example now of one being granted. So really interesting one, a very almost 20-year-old agreement established under the South Australian State Industrial System. So a bit of an unusual sort of agreement to still be kicking along. Effectively, the employer, with the support of the union, made the application to extend it. The commission has certain powers to extend the life of the agreement. It's got to meet particular criteria. There's got to be a new enterprise agreement being sought to be negotiated, which was the case here. It's got to cover the same or substantially similar group of employees, which again was the case here. And the bargaining must effectively be occurring. And so the employer here was able
to... And they must be better off overall.
Well, that's right. So the commission has to be satisfied that maintaining the status quo wouldn't result in the employees being less better off in versus the award. And uniquely here,
that's the amazing part of this case.
It's the 2004 deal.
They're still better off. So look, we're going to see this sort of stuff coming through. For most of you, you'll say, oh, look, this doesn't affect us. Truth is there's a whole lot of zombie enterprise agreements that are sitting out there, often in dark cupboards, and you really got to go back and do your
due diligence. Well, we spoke about that one where the employer had erroneously believed it just no longer applied.
Yep.
It was a 2017 deal with some sort of men's fashion brand.
Yeah.
Thought it didn't apply, and then was all of a sudden here going, oh.
One of them was selling flares.
Not sure if that's true.
So let's get on to Virgin and the intractable bargaining. Probably the history of intractable bargaining goes back to the Workplace Relations Act, and it came in after a Boeing dispute went on for 2 years and it allowed intervention through the Fair Work Commission to arbitrate and complete it. And they had to introduce it because there was no way out of the Boeing dispute. So in places where there are very strong differences in what people are paid in substantial industries. And Virgin, which we're going to talk about, and Qantas have around about a 12% difference in pay.
It's sizable.
So you're not surprisingly going to see, and there's about five unions that deal with the airline industry.
Yep, that's right, yeah.
There is no surprise that Virgin are involved in intractable bargaining. Now, they've had two sorts of voting on particular things.
That's right, yeah, majority.
How long has it been going on for, Matt?
I think it's 2 years.
2 years total, that it's been going on for. Yeah. And so tell us a little bit.
More than 2 years.
So who made the application?
Yeah, so the Virgin have actually made the application. So they've said, look, we feel that we have exhausted all reasonable attempts to get this deal over the line. We don't think that without any intervention from the Commission that we'll actually be able to get to a point where something will be able to be agreed. So, look, it's an interesting one. I think it's a great point, Andrew, that this is an example where it's going to be in these sorts of industries. And Virgin really have been wanting to be the ones to roll the dice here. They're saying, look, we're going to use it. You know, we're not going to allow the employees or the union to use it and come to us with it. We're going to say you're being unreasonable and we're going to try and get the Fair Work Commission.
And look, the helpful part is when you look at these disputes in the past where arbitration has happened in the Fair Work Commission, and you all have your views about where Fair Work Commission has come from. A large group of them have come out of unions. But in sophisticated organisations, there is a very clear understanding of what is the money and how does it work against margin. That Matt and I always tell you to actually do your numbers and be clear about it so that you can demonstrate that the a major increase in wages, and for most industries, that is the biggest cost.
Exactly. Yeah.
Erodes margin, makes businesses unprofitable. Mm. But if you don't have that data, you can't have that argument. But where these disputes have happened in the past, and there's a new piece of legislation, but it's built on from an old
system. That's right.
What you see is Fair Work Commissioners, when seized with clean evidence, are actually incredibly reasonable.
Yes.
So there will be more people who use this because the Commissioner's hands are tied when they get good evidence.
That's right. And it goes to a point that we made on the briefing last week, and I think that's relevant also again with the zombie deal we just talked about. Evidence is so important in these sorts of
evidence versus anecdote.
My goodness. You know, and I think the ones where these orders are going to be made are the ones where you can demonstrate the evidence. So, you know, here, for example, they talk about, there was, you know, several pieces of correspondence back and forth. Evidencing that correspondence, you know, cannot be anecdotal to simply go before the Commission and say, we've been trying for ages. Okay, well, where's your evidence?
I suppose you get tired of us saying document, but good, generous, clear, and remember, generous is really important.
Yeah.
Good, generous, clear documentation of what you're doing holds you in good stead in Fair Work Commission. You know, there's going to be a couple of other places where this is going to happen. So we're certainly going to see it in the university sector.
Yes, agreed. Yeah.
So there are a number of industries where this is going to come into play, but wherever there is a differential that exists between one major player and another, and there is a significant group of people employed in that industry and is union rich, going back to our conversation at the very start, we're going to see unions digging in.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we've got to get the communication right with our employees that the longer they dig in, nothing changes.
Exactly.
So that people understand that when they win their protracted history, they've actually lost the entire benefit of the 2 years they've been fighting.
Yeah, exactly.
And therefore the real return has been lost. Something that unions forget to tell people.
Yeah, and I think, look, it's interesting, I think, for this one, just on a final point of this, is that I think a lot of the commentary in the lead-up to these coming into effect was that it was going to be employees forcing, unions and employees forcing employers to be left with agreements that they're not happy with. But we're actually seeing it used the opposite way. Yeah. I mean, yes, this is only the first application of it, but it's a very interesting sort of test.
I think it's fascinating. Yeah. I'm only going to do a couple minutes on the next case, which is a spotless case, which was a guy who was
such a unique
sort of case. Is this an abandonment case? Not really, but it's coloured in that light.
Yeah.
Where a guy was arrested, remanded, held in incommunicado. The organisation.
Great way to describe it.
Yeah, I thought
That's your answer for this week.
The employer somewhat witlessly decided to actually use this as an abandonment method. They tried to serve correspondence but had no knowledge of whether that correspondence was received or could be responded to. The guy, many days after the expiry of the abandonment, the acceptance of abandonment, abandonment is, just to be really clear, is a form of repudiation. It's saying to somebody, you've left the work, you're not really willing and able to come to work.
That's right. Yep.
Therefore, we're accepting your actions as evincing an intention to no longer be bound by the contract. So it's not about frustration. It's about repudiation. And by you sending the letter that says we accept that, you're saying you repudiate, therefore you have no basis upon which you can bring a claim in the Fair Work Commission.
Yeah.
In simple terms. But this guy never got the correspondence.
No.
He never had a chance. He's well outside the period of time which he can make a claim. So this case is about an extension of time. What the commission said is, well, if he didn't know about it, and he brought an application as soon as he did know about it, from the moment at which he did know about it, time starts to run.
Yep.
So that's it.
That's right. And Nina and I talked about it, you and I talked about it, Andrew. I think this is one of those great examples where we don't know exactly what was put in the application, but if this sort of information that would be so incredulous that it could not have been falsified was presented to you, I'm not sure why the employer chose to waste the time and money jurisdictional objection.
Yeah, I sort of do in the sense that you know you're going to conciliate and settle.
Yes. They could have elected to go to the conciliation first, Andrew, that's the interesting
part. But then they buy in.
It's fair. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. It's just a lot of money.
Can I just say to you, for every dumb decision, there's a dumb decision maker. And so when you make a dumb decision, it's a dumb decision maker. And that person's pride usually gets in the road of common sense.
Yep.
And behind every dumb decision maker, there's a dumb lawyer. Mm. And you just get this pathway of stupidity that leads you to where you are. Anyway, probably a very unkind thing. Let's go on to the main topic.
Main topic.
I think I've just got a defamation letter. Notice of concerns.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. I think for Matt and I, one of the things that is most troubling, probably because of the place we live and work in, that it's not uncommon for people to come to work demonstrating clear mental health issues. Mm. I mean, one in four in the legal industry, it's about one in three, actually. Mm. About one in four people suffer a mental illness that impairs their capacity to undertake the inherent requirements of their job. Okay. So we're likely just by statistics to see or observe somebody who's struggling. We see it at different levels. Mm. We've talked many times about the monitoring obligations under Section 22 of safety legislation in Victoria, and the comparable piece of legislation throughout Australia requires you understand what it looks like in a person, and that's a relationship issue.
Mm.
As a leader, it's connecting to understand what's happening in people's lives.
Exactly. Yeah.
And it's being present for that person so you can determine what good looks like. Mm. So when good's not there, you see the slide.
That's right. Yeah.
And the case law unquestionably, when we look at Burke and Suncorp and those cases, say when a reasonable person could observe there's a movement away from good and it's impacting someone's capacity to do the inherent requirements, there is an obligation to intervene.
Yeah, that's right.
So I just wanted to set that light because we saw this terrible coroner's finding for the Tasmanian Ambulance where a person was displaying some bizarre behaviour which should have put anyone on notice that person was at risk and he posed risk to other people.
Mm.
The guy ultimately died. And the coroner was just excoriated the ambulance service for their failure to intervene on this established and recognised case law that says both in safety law and under workplace law, you must intervene.
Mm.
Now, we've been lucky, I think, as a jurisdiction, and now it's throughout Australia with Kozeroff, where the issues of particular risk have been concentrated on by a court and says, and Matt works in this environment, okay? Mm. So I want to use a law firm to give an example.
Yeah, I think it's a great example.
Law is a high-risk environment. Mm. Why is law a high-risk environment? It's not something you can switch off from. So when Matt turns his phone off at night, he can't switch his brain off.
No, that's true.
That's because Matt's a bit weird. No. It means he'll have three or four matters of real urgency that are ticking away in his brain, but he understands he's got to be there for text and grace, he's got to be present at home, and he has to switch off. So when he turns the phone off, he doesn't turn his brain off.
Mm.
Some of those are issues which are challenging people's lives and livelihoods.
Mm.
So in our environment, I know we're in a high-risk environment.
That's right, from the environment.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So in our environment, Kozeroff, which is the High Court case, says if you know someone is exposed to a high-risk environment, then your obligation is at common law is like a positive duty.
Yeah. Yep.
Now, we know under psychological hazards, there is a positive duty.
Yes.
We know in relation to sex discrimination and harassment there's a positive duty. That is a duty to understand the risks that are assessed and collect evidence to ensure that when Matt does turn off the phone, he enjoys the confidence of the business that it's safe to switch off his phone.
Yes, that's right.
Does that make sense? Mm. But if Matt came in and said, we were chatting yesterday with Tex, Tex is not so flash, he needs to get home. So this case law is all around not observing someone with a mental health issue.
Yeah.
It's about preventing someone
from
having a mental health issue.
That's right. And I think one of the things we get raised with us by clients quite a lot is there's this trepidation around understanding or seeking to get a better understanding of their individual employees' personal circumstances. You know, I mean, obviously, people don't want to be seen to be prying. They don't want to be seen to be stepping into the personal and the private. But that's unfortunately that politeness, which I might call it, which people perhaps once would have said this is an acceptable way to go. One keeps these two things entirely separate, work and personal. It's just not reflective of two things. One, a modern working environment where, using your example, Andrew, it's not really that easy to switch off. Even a tradie who puts down the tools doesn't leave the stresses of the workplace where the tool is left. And also that there is this increasing case law that says you actually have to do more. You've got to take those positive steps. You need to get the information you need to inquire. So clients should feel comforted by the fact that the law supports an inquisitorial approach if there is a demonstration of risk.
Yeah. So look, can I put that in a very simple term for you? When someone walks through the door, the moment they walk through the door, they're yours. We know that around about 70% of the stresses that lead to mental health are actually not work, they're home.
Mm.
So when a person comes to you and you see changes the way they behave, the fact that they're from home don't change the fact that you're now on risk and safety law and all workplace law. So as Matt said, you've got to have that relationship. Now, it's not prying. It is being candid about saying, look, hey, Matt, you're looking a bit stressed. Yeah. Is there something we can do to help? And Matt tells me what's going on. They go, okay, let's do this. Mm. Okay. But privacy law, the moment it goes to the inherent requirements of the job, lifts.
That's right, yeah.
And therefore, building leadership skill around relationship and engagement is the only modern and respectable method of actually complying with the current law.
Yeah.
So this idea of sort of territorial behaviour where there is a leader who keeps this distance, it's just bullshit.
Yeah.
And it's illegal.
Yes.
And it's done.
That's right.
So anyway, let's go on. Seeing we're going live, I've already done it.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go on to the case study.
I can read it today. Oh, there you go. All right. Danielle looked tired. She'd been working rotating shift work for the last few years, had two young children, and her husband was a FIFO worker. Her youngest boy suffered from a blood disorder. He was aged 6. There were times when she would have to leave work urgently and take him to a hospital. Her manager, Sven, knew her life was tough, but she was a resilient and private soul. Over the last 3 months, her son had suffered 3 episodes requiring hospitalisation, all when her husband was away. She had several colds and the business had decided to change shift structures to permanent shifts, to something which would drain to breaking point her family resources to care for the children. The new shift structure was implemented in accordance with the EA, requiring 14 days notice. On day 13 of the notice period, Danielle is seen crying in the crib room. No one has spoken to her about the new shifts, and she just found out she was going on permanent nights in 3 days' time. She had no way of arranging childcare. Everyone had seen her deteriorate since the announcement. Her hair was unwashed, her expression stressed and sad, and her work had dropped off. Several had approached Sven and raised it with him. He had said he feels sorry for her, but she needs to suck it up. As she was leaving, her mental state rendered her distracted. She walked out in front of a forklift in the outward bound dispatch area.
All right. So a sad tale. But the first question was, had Sven and her employer committed any breach of safety law? And if so, what was it?
Absolutely. The breach of the primary duty here.
So well, you've got the breach of safe workplace and the monitor, and you've got a breach of the safety system.
Yes.
So you're in huge trouble, and unquestionably, the organisation would be prosecuted.
Yes.
Can I just say, on a fatigue level, they would be at risk.
Yeah.
If nothing else. Better get the mental health issue. Yeah. You've got a woman who's demonstrating obvious fatigue.
Yeah.
You've got a woman who's got distress, and there has been no intervention at all.
No, that's right. Well, in fact, it's the complete opposite, isn't it?
Yes.
They're trying to wash their hands of it entirely, telling you to suck it up. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Now we get into the funny stuff. If Sven disciplined her for poor performance, would she have a good general protection?
Oh, my goodness. Yes, absolutely. He would have to be give evidence as the decision maker, and to try and say that her performance issues can be completely divorced from the clear health issues would just not being able to be sustained.
Well, it's even in some ways because it completely breached the obligations of consultation, both under safety law and under the reward.
There's nowhere Sven can go. No, he's got nowhere to go.
Interesting in this case, both the organisation and Sven would be named in a general protection and we'll talk more about discrimination later.
Yeah.
What I want people to understand is in the first two questions here, Sven is going to be charged or part of any proceeding.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you name him as a knowingly involved.
So coming back to what Matt and I said about engagement, relationships, Sven didn't do it. Let's go to the next question. Okay, Matt, shoot. Was Danielle discriminated?
Yes, I did. Because we don't often get to talk about indirect discrimination. But, I mean, there's clear direct discrimination as well, which is that they know of her family and caring responsibilities and they've completely taken adverse action effectively against her because of that. But it's interesting, I think there's also an argument that this change of the shift structure is a form of indirect discrimination. So it's the imposition of a requirement which affects a group of people with a particular attribute to their detriment. And it clearly does here. You know, this imposition of the permanent shifts has negatively affected not only Danielle, but obviously any other parent or person with parent and caring responsibilities.
And this is such a big warning. Can I just say that because this clause does exist in a lot of enterprise agreements, it doesn't change the common law and discrimination law obligation of consultation and making reasonable adjustments.
That's right, which flows quite nicely to the next question.
Which is a requirement to individually assess a person's circumstances rather than to use a broad brush.
That's right, that's right. And what we know from the fact scenario is that they didn't bother to speak to her directly at all. So it's not even that you could say that there is some general consultation that she elected not to participate in or anything like that.
So jump into four, mate.
Jump into four. So, it did breach industrial and safety law obligations of consultation. So it's failing to consult properly the individual employees involved. Consultation is not just simply some sort of label that you stick on top of some sort of surface-level engagement with people. You do have to take into account those individual circumstances. Their entitlements of an individual employee to be able to enforce against an employer. So you must have evidence to show that those individuals and the individual circumstances were properly considered.
And look, can I just say why safety law is such an interesting fact here? Mm-hmm. When we talk about consultation and safety law, we normally look about the commissioning of a new machine or a new line in the factory. But just remember psychological hazards. So you put that up there and you say, look, we're doing something which by its very nature creates a psychological hazard. Mm. Therefore, if it creates one which changes the manner in which work is going to be done, there must be individual risk assessments undertaken as part of safety. So psychological safety has broadened the ambit of the consultation obligations unquestionably within safety.
Yeah.
So you have to do that at the stage of the risk assessment. Then as you go to implement and the decision has been made, so there's two different times, you then go into the consultation required under the law. So there are two periods of consultation.
That's right.
Not one collapsed into how you're feeling about that bad luck off you go, all right?
Yeah, that's right. I think that's probably misunderstood.
Okay. Danielle died.
Yes.
Industrial manslaughter.
Yes. So there's the breach of the primary duty. It was reckless and
it was is there a primary duty breach? Yes, there is a primary duty breach.
Yes, which we established earlier.
It only relates to the officer in the organisation. Mm. So the next question is, was the nature of the breach of such a high level that it reaches a criminal negligence?
Yes.
Okay, well, we'll have a look at this. There was a knowledge that was held by a supervisor and by all people present, and there wasn't a system that would have prevented it.
Yeah.
So you're on the cusp. I think Matt was looking more at reckless. I think that's right. I think the charge would actually be, was there a knowledge which would have been had Sven liable and would have the organisation liable? Did Sven hold a knowledge of serious injury? Yes.
Yep.
Was he indifferent to it? Yes.
Yes.
Reckless endangerment, 5 years in jail, $3 million fines.
Yep.
But no, it doesn't make it to industrial manslaughter. Because it doesn't, we don't have the evidence besides a failure of a system to actually hold an officer, and therefore we don't get the criminal negligence
at
all. Okay, and the second thing is, does the person die, and does it matter where they die?
Yes. No,
it
doesn't. Oh, actually, we didn't know that she died. She died.
There you go.
There we go.
But it looked fascinating today. Thanks, Matt. Lovely to be back and catch up with you.
Wonderful, absolutely.
And lovely to be live.
Yeah, live, so to speak.
See you next week. Thumbs up, please.
Bye. Thanks so much.